Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Artist First World Radio Network, home of the best new music you've never heard, and home of the best new talk shows you need to hear. Please don't forget to visit our archives page at www.artistfirst.com, where you can hear all our past shows for free and on demand. You were tuning in to Crime Beat. This show airs every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For more information about this show and to listen to past shows for free, please visit artistfirst.com/crimebeat.htm. And don't forget to follow Artist First on Twitter. You can find us under the Twitter handle at @artist_first. Now here are your hosts of Crime Beat, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Harib, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night. And it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. Well, Ronnie, our listeners tonight are in store for a great show this evening. Crime Beat is delighted to bring you Allison Statman and Bree Tate, authors of the best-selling book titled Restless Souls, The Sharon Tate Family's Account of Stardom, The Manson Murders, and A Crusade for Justice. On the second half of the broadcast, we're thrilled to announce the appearance of Dr. Michael Stone, author of the spine-chilling book titled Anatomy of Evil. Dr. Stone is a world-renowned psychiatrist who'll get us in the mind of the infamous mass murderer Anders Behring Breivik and his murderous rampage in Norway last year. It's going to be a fascinating show, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the unflappable Mr. Ronnie Jepsik. Ron's an award-winning author, documentary producer, director, and publisher. He's also a two-time Fulbright scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia, and a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series. His book, Sergeant Smack, has been optioned for a movie. His latest project is the just-released documentary, The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kinkman. For more information, please go to Strategic Media Books. That's www.strategicmediabooks.com. Given his books, his extensive travels, and in-depth interviews, Ron Jepsik today is the leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Now, take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio on my co-host, Willie Harib. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist in Thunder Bay, Canada, which happens to be my hometown, and he has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in international shipping business, where he is a contributing writer to several trade publications. Last year, he published Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay area. Volume 2 is coming out early 2013, and this fall, he'll publish another book with Ellie Warner, a book about the famous Ganelda shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossburn, Lake Superior. Willie.
Thanks for that, Ronnie. Your promos are getting A1. Thank you very much. Well, you know what? Our book, Movers and Mavericks, is almost sold out, and it'll be coming out in book form later this fall. Now, just before I reach into our mailbag and read some mail we received, I'd like to thank all our listeners out there from around the world, that's around the globe, for tuning into Crime Beat. There's no turning back the clock now, Ronnie. We're thrilled and delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments and thumbs up about our program. Now, we'd just like to thank some of our operations staff at Artist First Radio, in particular, Corey, Scott, and Tony for making this show possible. Also, a special muchas gracias to the Ryan brothers, who allowed us to use their music as our theme track. Like I said many times, Ronnie Boy, internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're right on track. Well, Ronnie, now here's this week's mailbag. This one is from Genevieve of Montreal, Canada, who writes, "It's about time you had a fiction show. You guys should do more of the same. Great interviews with Ed Falco and John Land. I read John Land's book and love his woman Texas Ranger's character. She's one heck of a role model for women. Also picked up the Family Corleone book the other day. So far, a turn pager of a book. Have to admit, I'm a real Godfather junkie. Any comments, Ronnie?"
Yeah, it was a real thrill to have Ed Falco on talking about the next book in the Godfather franchise. And, Yeah, we're going to have more fiction shows. It's one of our more popular shows, and if our listeners have suggestions for crime fiction authors who might want to who we might want to invite on the show, please send in your suggestions.
Willie? Well, yeah, I'll tell you, the crime fiction is really popular with our women audience out there. So we've got to train our sights on that for a few shows.
Right.
Now, Roddy, tell our listeners out there in that wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show.
Yes, we're going to have Richard Mute and Charles Buckley. He's going to talk about a real character, Robert Radan. And the book is called The Charmer, the true story of Robert Radan. He was a rapist, murderer, and millionaire. And a woman just loves this character. So
what
it's going to be it's going to be a fascinating book. I've read it, and it's really a chilling book, how this guy was able to manipulate the opposite sex. Willie?
Yeah, well, thanks for that, Ronnie. It's going to be a great show. Now, tell us what you're up to in the next couple of weeks. I hear you're going to do some vegetating for a few days, buddy.
Well, I'm staying close to home, but I might have some big news on my Frank Matthews project, my screenplay. A couple people are looking at it, and something may develop in the next week or so with that, and hopefully it will. So I'll let you all know. Hopefully next week or the week after on that. Otherwise, it's close to the vest and keep doing what I'm doing.
Well, you better stock that beer fridge. I hear it's about 95 degrees there every day.
God, I'm telling you, it's really bad up here.
Well, it's practically the same up here in Thunder Bay. So my beer fridge is always stocked.
Yeah, you got Canadian beer. It's better than American beer, of course.
I'm telling you, you bet. Now, Ronnie, as you know, the beat to crime never stops. It never, never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet features a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. Now, here's this week's rap sheet. Dateline, July 16th, 2012. Center County, Pennsylvania. Paterno family denies 267-page report findings by former FBI Director Louis Free that Joe Paterno concealed Jerry Sandusky's sexual abuse of children. Hey, Ronnie, Joe Paterno's family vowed their own investigation. Hey, Ronnie, the Paterno family's rounding up the covered wagons.
Real sad, I'm telling you. You know, it was a bitter blow to the Paterno family, that report. You know, they're like the Windsors, you know, of England. You know, royalty in Penn State. Now they're taking down, they're changing the name of Paternoville. The students took the name, you know, off that meeting place where they camped out for tickets, and then they're going to take that statue down maybe. So it's a real real blow for them, and you can't really expect them to say anything else on that, but it's really sad. And unfortunately, we're not going to hear the end of this story. I read a report, which many people probably missed, that there's another couple of victims step forward, this time from the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
So this can go way back there. And, you know, this guy worked for Paterno for a long time, so I wouldn't be surprised if more dirt comes out, unfortunately, staining the Paterno legacy. Willie?
Well, the victims, the poor kids that Sandusky abused, they're the real victims.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a word called Sandusky. You know, it's a person who destroys himself and everybody around him.
Yeah, it's sad. We'll keep an eye on that one. Now, just before we get on with our featured guests tonight, Allison Statman and Bree Tate, we'll take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Shepsick and yours truly, Will Harib. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have a question for our guest, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be glad to hear from you and try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, Crime Beat's first guests tonight are Allison Statman and Bree Tate, authors of Restless Souls. They'll talk about the gruesome murders of the beautiful and talented actress Sharon Tate, her unborn child, and four others that same night at the hands of the notorious Manson family, which rocked the nation as one of the most horrific crimes in modern history. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Bree Tate and Alisa Statman.
Thank you.
Great. Well, there's such a fascination with the tragic incident that happened 43 years ago. So I would imagine the book's doing pretty good as far as selling, right?
It has. It's done very, very well. Very happy.
Right. Well, how did you two come together to do this book? Could you give a little background on yourself so we understand where the story is coming from?
Patty Tate was my partner for 9 years before she passed away from breast cancer, and we actually started this book back in 1993, and it was her autobiography. And sadly, she passed away before we could get publication.
Mm-hmm.
And, about 5 years ago, Bree found it and really felt like we should get it out to people. Mm-hmm. And at some point, I figured out how to turn it into a family memoir as opposed to Patty's autobiography, and that it could be told through four of the Tate family members' perspective, Sharon's parents, PJ and Doris, her sister Patty, and then, of course, Bree's. And so that was the evolution of it to, what it ended up as today.
Right. Well, what was the purpose in doing the book? What were you trying to say with the book?
For me, it was, the fact that since Sharon's murder, the Tate family has really, picked themselves up by the bootstraps to become a positive force, beginning with Sharon's father, PJ's investigation into Sharon's murder, her mother, Doris, and sister Patty's fight to keep the killers in prison. And with all of them gone, I wanted to carry their voice and their positive force into another generation. I think that people remember the crimes, they remember the circumstances, they certainly remember the Manson family, but I think what's been overshadowed here throughout the years are the victims and the senseless, horrible way that their lives ended that night.
Right. How about you, Bree? What was your reason for doing the book? You're third generation, right? Been affected by this crime, which is a heck of a long time. What was your purpose?
Definitely. Well, for me, the same reasons as Lisa, but, something that she didn't mention, we actually had the notes of my grandfather and my grandmother, who also tried to write a book. So for me, it was really important to try and kind of just finish with something that they had all started. So it was my way of honoring them.
Right. Now, some of our readers may be, I know a lot of our listeners will probably be too young to remember, the incident. So maybe you can tell us a little bit who Sharon Tate was and what type of person she was and how the family remembers her. Bree?
Well, for me, it's maybe a little different compared to what other people know about her. She died years before I was even born, but my mom, always made it very important to make her a key figure in our lives. And, there were pictures of her all around the house. They always just kind of talked about her as if she was away or living in another country, I was I never really understood exactly what happened to her until I was a little bit older, and then I kind of started to understand what exactly my grandma was doing, why she was becoming so, why she was fighting so hard for victims' rights, and, I was probably around 10, 11 until when I really finally understood.
Right. I would imagine that it was really hard dealing with the tragedy, given the really evil shadow of the Manson family, right? Mm-hmm. That was part of it. You couldn't get away from the Manson.
No.
Stuff. So that, that probably exacerbated, the difficulty.
Well, and that's what made my grandmother so angry.
Right.
Here she is trying to deal with, Sharon dying and in such a terrible way. Yet it was also very public, so people were saying terrible things about her, awful things. And this really made my grandma and my grandfather extremely angry, having to listen to this. They're trying to deal with their pain and suffering, and then having to listen to people on the news say all these terrible rumors about Sharon, which were not true.
Right, I would imagine. Now, Elisa, did the book turn up any new information about the murder?
About the murder itself? No.
Yes.
No.
What about the whole, the whole background and the whole milieu of the crime? Is there anything new that was uncovered?
The new thing that Russell Soles is about is what happened with this family and the positive force that they did. PJ Tate did an entire investigation with three of his friends from the Department of Defense, and that entire investigation, at the end of it, they found the Manson family before Los Angeles Police Department did. And just what happens to a family, especially in a crime that's so public and so media savvy, and what's happening behind the scenes and what's happening to this family and what they're going through. And, you could really take it and and look at it almost as a behind the scenes to what Vince Bugliosi wrote in Helter Skelter, which is everything that was happening in the public. Well, what was happening to this family? What was happening during the trial? What you know, the fact that T.J. Tate was the first witness to it, and that he went to the trial every single day, and his encounters with the Manson family, had two encounters with the Manson family, and the fact that P.J. Tate had to go up to the crime scene itself and clean up Sharon's his daughter's own blood to appease a lawsuit. You know, those are the things that people have never heard about, and I think that they're important things for people to understand of what happens to a victim and their you know, next of kin after a crime has happened.
Right.
I think that, you know, one of the most important aspects of this book is that the Tate family's circumstances are not an isolated incident. They are the universal cry of all crime victims. And I think showing that side of it, especially in a case that's been so, portrayed in the media in a different way, is really important.
Right. You were just a child when Sharon was murdered, Bree. When did you begin to understand that the tragedy was part of your family history?
Well, she was killed long before I was even born. But I understood, like I said, I always knew who Sharon was. Mm-hmm. She was always a big part of my life. Mm-hmm. But they never actually sat me down and explained what happened
until I
was much older.
Yeah, I think a big watershed moment for Bree was the day when she was just going through her mother's drawers looking for something to wear out to dinner, and she came across the crime scene photos. And
right.
You know, we talk about that in Restless Souls, and the effect of, you know, just an innocent thing of a child going through her mother's drawers to find these crime scene photos. And it was an eye-opening experience, and like, you know, we put in the book, she finally understood why parents felt the need to sleep near guns, and her grandmother had three locks on the doors and bars on the window.
Wow.
It all kind of comes together for you in that one moment of seeing that these aren't, especially for a child, these aren't werewolves and vampires and ghosts, you know, doing these horrible things to one another. These are human beings.
Right. Well, you know, listeners may think that it was a little paranoid putting bars on the doors, but I understand that the Manson family actually, you know, tormented your family, Bree. Is that right? That they reached out and, you know, it didn't really end that night. It didn't really end that night. You had to deal with this monster and his fanatical followers.
Well,
Patty
received, you know, a threatening letter that, you know, says when the Manson sisters get out of prison, what they do to you will make everybody finally forget about, you know, what happened to your own sister. And, you know, let's not forget that it's not just, you know, these people reaching out and writing these horrible letters. It's the fact that year after year after year, they have to go to parole hearings and not only relive these murders, but listen to how great these people are. And sitting, you know, 5 feet away from them, listening to how great these prisoners are doing. You know, they've written books. They've gotten married. They've had children. They have conjugal visits. And when you think back to what they did to Sharon, stabbing her 16 times, you know, that's a really hard pill to swallow.
Right. You attended parole hearings, right, Bree?
Yes, and Lisa. Well, I went to Susan Atkins' parole hearings.
Susan, and you described that in the book, and it's very chilling, your description in the book. Well, what kind of impact did that have on you, and why did you go to the parole hearing knowing that, you know, that it could be a traumatic experience for you?
It was. You know, my grandmother had gone, my mom had gone, and they had both passed, and I felt the need to go and, you know, give my impact statement, which in the end I was actually not allowed to give. It was surreal to look at her and be in the same room with the woman that actually killed her, you know. It was very strange. And like Lisa said, they're praising her, and it made me sick. It was disgusting.
Right. Why couldn't you give an impact statement?
It's a great question. I don't know, because my aunt was there, so she was the next of kin, and she was
But they allowed your family to give a statement.
Absolutely.
Good. On that sort of thing. So you think that she was still a threat to society, that if she got out, you know, she would still be, you know, a potential...
Well, I think that all of these guys are threats to society.
Right.
And none of them should ever be released. I think it's disgusting that they're even coming up for parole. You know, we have to remember that back when they were sentenced, they were sentenced to the death penalty.
That's right.
It's because of a fluke in our system that they're actually still here.
Right.
So,
and I think that, you know, Bree touched on something, and that is the fact that they were sentenced to death. The fact that these people are allowed to live is gift enough.
Mm-hmm.
And as Patty Tate always says, you know, you took a life, you pay for it with your own life.
Right.
And, you know, at Susan Atkins' very last hearing, you know, she was diagnosed with a cancerous brain tumor, and they were looking mm-hmm. for compassionate release. And we put this in Russell Souls as well. But, you know, the fact that it's very, very difficult to look at anybody who's suffering and not feel compassion for them.
Right.
But I think what Bree said is really important, and that is to look back at who this person was, who Susan Atkins was back in 1969,
right.
and her actions.
Right.
And that's the person that we kind of need to remember.
Right.
And the parole board made it clear as well. I mean, they knew that Susan Atkins had a matter of months to live, and they gave her a 3-year denial. And I think that that's a pretty clear signal that they don't intend to let any of these people out.
Right. Well, an interesting part of your book is the title, you know, Restless Souls. Does that sort of imply that that there's been no closure for the family? Like you mentioned Doris, the mom, you mentioned Paul Tate, the dad, and you mentioned Patty, Sharon's sister, and they're all passed away. Before they left us, I mean, was there any kind of relief from this nightmare? Nightmare that has, you know, plagued your family for such a long time?
No, you know, we hear the word closure a lot when it comes to crime victims, especially, you know, next to kin of murder victims. And again, we put this in Russell's Souls, and that is that, you know, there is no closure. And as Patty Tate said, you know, it's a gaping wound that you learn to live with.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly, there is never any closure. As long as the people are still alive, as long as the parole hearings continue, then there is never going to be closure. And even if these people had been killed, you know, even if they'd been given a death sentence and that had been carried out, there's still no closure for these families because we talk about this as parents who murder children. You know, each step of the way, a parent whose child has been murdered, they think that this is going to make it better. They think the trial is going to make it better and the conviction is going to make it better and possibly a carried out death sentence, only to find out that as each of those stages continues on, it has not helped. And I just want to say, you know, really quickly that any parent out there or anybody who's lost a loved one to murder, please go out and get help. Go find Parents of Murdered Children. Go find a self-help group. Because, you know, one of the things that Doris Tate did was, you know, when Sharon was murdered, let's look back to that, there were no victims' rights. There were no advocacy groups.
Right.
There was none of that, and she had to deal with this alone. And one of her big things was reaching out to people and trying to help them get through what she had already lived through.
Wow. I've got a quick question for Bree, Ronnie.
Mm-hmm.
Bree, do you have children of your own?
Yes.
How are you going to tell your children to look at this? Have you counseled them now, or are they too young?
No, right now they're too young. You know, it's a great question. I actually haven't given much thought into it. I guess probably...
Well, that's the fourth generation,
right?
That's the fourth generation. You know, so
right.
It's going to go on. With that, let's take a break, Willie. It's a fascinating interview. We'll be back and continue our discussion.
You bet, Ronnie. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb. Our very special guests tonight are Bree Tate and Allison Stadman. Now back to Ron and Allison and Bree.
Thank you, Willie. Lisa and Bree, thank you for being on the show again, and we're discussing your book, Restless Souls, The Sharon Tate Family Account of Stardom, Manson Murders, and A Crusade for Justice. And I guess this book's everywhere, right? If people want to go out and get this book, Amazon bookstores, right?
Yeah, I mean, I always advocate your local bookstore to support local
booksellers,
but yes, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, iTunes, anywhere you can buy
a book. We have a lot of international listeners in 120 countries. Has your book been sold, the rights been sold, Rod?
Well, yet? They're selling it, especially on Amazon, through the Italian Amazon, the French Amazon, UK, so it's available almost anywhere.
Right.
It's really great when I get notes on Twitter from people like Spain and France who are reading
it. Great.
It's really kind of amazing.
Right. That's great. Yes, I would imagine, because this crime was so, you know, world famous. And you have a Twitter account which people can hook up with. How about you, Bree?
No, I go through Lisa.
You're the quiet one of the duo,
Lisa.
Right?
Yeah, a little bit.
On that sort of thing. Okay, on that. Well, getting back to our discussion, was really interesting, was that you were pregnant. We were talking about your children, and your daughter was about 3 or 4 right now when you're working on this book. And did you think more about the fact that Sharon was 8 months pregnant when she was murdered?
I absolutely. You know, it was probably the first time in my life that I actually felt a real connection to Sharon.
Right.
Because I was feeling exactly what she was feeling in those last days of her life. And, you know, just every kick, the excitement of being pregnant, wanting to see your new baby,
right,
you know,
right.
And just how sad it is that she never got that. She never got to see that baby. They took it away from her.
And right.
Absolutely.
Now,
I definitely felt close to her in those moments.
Wow. Right. The other part of the title, of course, is Crusade for Justice. And this is a real interesting part of your family, is that you've reached out. You know, you've not just dealt with your own situation, but you reached out. Let's talk a little about that. I think Doris, the mom, was very active in this area, right?
Doris Tate was a huge victims advocate, nationwide. She was from the grassroots from 1982 when the Victims' Bill of Rights went through. When they got that passed through, it changed the game for victims. They were now part of the entire process, from the sentencing to the subsequent parole hearings. And once they got that passed through, she started working on tougher laws. And once she was healed enough, which, we talk about this, took her almost 13 years before she could even really and truly admit that Sharon was gone. But when she was healed enough, she not only counseled victims of crime on the grieving and the judicial process, but she counseled hardened criminals and forced them to take a long look at the lasting effects that their crimes had on their victims. And then, of course, in the end, she was honored by President Bush as one of his 1,000 points of light. So the work that she did was truly amazing and worth, every bit of it.
And is the family carrying on her good work?
Well, Patty, on Doris's deathbed, she asked Patty to continue on her work, and Patty did until she was diagnosed with breast cancer herself. And of course, Bree did, begin going to the parole hearings. What's different is when Patty and Doris were going to the parole hearings, no one else from the victims' families were attending. They were the only two to ever attend. When Doris was alive, she went to only Susan Atkins and Watson's hearings because at the time there was only a 1-year denial. So, if she had gone to all the hearings, they would have, been like once every 3 months, and that was a little too much for her to handle.
Mm-hmm.
When Patty Tate took over, she was the first one to go to Patricia Kremwinkel's parole hearing. Now, the victims are very, very well supported. We have the LaBianca families have come forward and the Sebring families have come forward. So it's a whole different, atmosphere as to what it was back when Patty and Doris were fighting to keep these people in prison.
Right. Well, what's really amazing is I understand that Manson is coming up for parole this year.
He was up for parole in April.
Oh, he's been up already this year.
Yeah, it was his parole date, and he was denied for 15 years.
For 15 years. He's what, he's late 70s now?
Yeah, so,
probably his last denial.
Yeah, well, he's like a cockroach. I guess he'll live forever, right?
they don't want him on the other side any more than we want him here, I think.
Yeah, I believe that. But, I'm a big fan of his movies. And Roman Polanski, has he stayed in touch with the family? Is there any connection with him still?
Not anymore. Roman was a difficult and confusing situation for Sharon's parents.
Mm-hmm.
He and we say this in the book, everybody deals with grieving differently, and his way to deal with it was to go to the house that he shared with Sharon, pack up his belongings, and walk away from everything else that encompassed his marriage to Sharon. And that was really very confusing to Sharon's parents, because while they're going through this grieving process, the father of their grandchild was not there. They kept in touch for years, over the holidays. Roman would call on the anniversary of the murders.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually that kind of went by the wayside. Doris went to see Roman in 1990. She visited with him. But now there's very little contact. The last time I spoke with him was when I wanted to open up Sharon's gravesite so that we could bury Patty in there.
Right.
And at that time, he was dealing with Rosie Blanchard, who claims that she's Sharon's unborn child. So that was the last contact that we've had with him.
Right, on that. Well, the book is excellent. It's a page-turner. And what about movie rights? Is there going to be any discussion about movie rights optioning your book?
There's been some offers at the moment. We're just concentrating on the book itself and trying to get the word out. That's the most important thing, is sharing the story and getting it out there. So we'll see what the future brings.
Right. Well, we really enjoyed having you on the show, and keep us informed of what's going on, and we'll have you on again. And good luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, Allison. Thanks, Bree. Well, Ronnie, special thank you to our very special guest. Now, just before we get on to our second segment of our show, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib, while our production staff hooks up with Dr. Michael H. Stone for the second half of the broadcast. We'll hand it over to Corey of Artist First World Radio for some brief remarks.
Crime Beat executive producer Ron Chepsik is not only a co-host of the show, he's also a crime writer and a publisher of other talented writers as well. Go to the publisher's website at strategicmediabooks.com to check these popular books out. Ron's books include the award-winning Sergeant Smack, The Lives and Times of Ike Atkinson, Kingpin and His Band of Brothers, which has been optioned for a movie, Queenpins, the first book exclusively about women gangsters, The Traficantes, Godfathers from Tampa, Florida, The Mafia, The CIA, and The JFK Assassination. You can also buy books by such noted true crime authors such as Pat O'Connor, author of Scapegoat, Scott Deitch, author of Rogue Mobster, Scott Wilson, author of Straight from the Hood, and Seth Ferranti, author of Prison Stories. Keep up with the new books coming out by joining the company's hot new mailing list. To get on it, email strategicmediabooks@gmail.com. That's STRATEGIC, mediabooks@gmail.com. The books from Strategic Media Books are also available at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com and through your favorite bookstore. When you go to Strategic Media Books' website, mention that you caught the buzz from the Crime Beat Radio Show and you will get $3 off any purchase. Again, the website is StrategicMediaBooks.com, STRATEGIC, MediaBooks.com. Come on down and you won't be disappointed. Back to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network.
Thanks, Corey. Tonight on our second half of our program brings you preeminent world-famous forensic psychiatrist, Dr. Michael Stone. Dr. Stone will discuss the horrendous case and bring us into the mind of mass murderer Anders Behring Breivik. Breivik confessed to the July 22, 2011 bombing and shooting rampage that killed 77 people. 8 in a bomb blast in Oslo and 69 on Utoya Island. The far-right fanatic rejected criminal guilt, saying the victims had betrayed Norway by embracing Islamic colonization. Disguised as a policeman, Breivik calmly and methodically went on a harrowing shooting spree that left 77 young men and women dead at the site of the annual governing Labour Party youth camp. Stick around for this interview. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Dr. Stone.
Thank you.
Great. You're really on top of this subject. You're going to be speaking on a panel, right?
That's right.
Where's that going to be?
Well, there's one in Oslo itself on the day before the second judgment in October. I'm sorry, August 24. There's going to be a decision. I'm giving a talk on the 23rd. That's going to be videotaped and then given again on September 4. That's in Oslo, and then August 27. And that Monday, I'm going to be in Stockholm on a panel with a Swedish psychiatrist,
right,
also talking about the Breivik case.
Right. So there's a lot of interest among your colleagues and profession about this case, right? Is it a unique case, or does it fit any pattern?
No, it's not unique. It's rare, mercifully.
Oh, it's rare. How is it rare? You know, we just assume he's just a mass killer.
Well, let's put it this way. There are lots of mass murderers. I have a Excel spreadsheet where I try to track these fellows, and they're usually fellows. Very rare for a woman to engage in mass murder. And I have over 200, but the majority of them are not political ones like this fellow.
Mm-hmm.
They're jealous people who feel betrayed by a spouse that has left them or something, and then the one fellow who went postal and gave post office a bad name, who killed 14 people. People like the disgruntled workers. They're usually paranoid men. The closest analogy, I think, to Breivik is Timothy McVeigh, a anti-government, loner, paranoid, disgruntled guy that was mad at the way the FBI treated David Koresh and that group in Waco, Texas, and then decided that the way to get back at the government was to bomb the building in Oklahoma City.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's interesting is that when you're going to be talking among your colleagues, the focusing on the issue, the topic, I understand, is mad versus bad.
Yes.
Is he mad or is he bad? I mean, that's the big question, and it seems to be that's the thing they're trying to decide at that trial, right?
Yes. The first wave of psychiatrists, Norwegian psychiatrists, who examined him felt that he was paranoid schizophrenic.
Right.
I didn't think there was much meat on that bone, granted that they had the advantage of actually talking to him, which I did not. But nevertheless, and then there was also the question of insanity. And I have a lot of close friends who are forensic Norwegian psychiatrists, and I was in touch with them and saying, hey, do you guys measure insanity in a different way than we do? Because insanity it used to be, of course, a word that just meant not a sound mind,
it's
a Latin word, and it just was a very vague word that people were crazy, they were nuts, they were insane.
Right.
But in the last 150 years, it's become a legal term that we don't use in psychiatry as a diagnosis. It's a legal diagnosis, if you will, that means the person committed an offense, a crime, but did not know the nature of his act due to mental illness, and nor whether it was right or wrong. Now, that is a very tough standard. It derived from the famous McNaughton case in 1843, when Daniel McNaughton was disgruntled that he wasn't getting access to the prime minister appeal, and tried to shoot him. He ended up shooting his poor secretary instead, but he was flat out crazy in the sense of just flamboyantly psychotic, and was felt therefore not responsible the way an ordinary person would be, and so he was called insane. Now, to mount an insanity defense these days, you have to show that a person was really grossly delusional and just way out of contact with reality, and not knowing what he was doing or that it was wrong, not even to know that it was wrong. That's an extremely tough standard. All the years I've been in this business, and in the 30 years I've been involved in forensics, I think I can only come up with about four people, one of whom I interviewed for the Most Evil television program, that I would consider insane. and they were very, very crazy and delusional, had weird ideas. Mm-hmm. And one woman shot her landlord, thinking that he was in league with the Kennedys and the Nazis to take over the country. I mean, come on.
Mm, really?
And
we got Michelle Bachmann that's talking pretty crazy. Talking about Muslims controlling the U.S. government. Is there any difference between that and some of the patients
that
you talked to?
This woman also felt that her landlord was putting poison in her coffee and all this kind of stuff. So, and she called the police as though she were doing a favor to the community by saving the world from this horrible person, and did not hide from what she did at all. I interviewed her. She took a false name. There's this soap called Dial Soap. She thought it was owned by the Dial family. Of course, it's only the name of the soap. It's like Mr. and Mrs. Ivory don't own Ivory Soap. So her real name was different, and she took this name as though she were a scion of this wealthy family. She's so crazy. And when I interviewed her, she was as crazy as, I don't want to say loon for Canadian, but she was very crazy.
Right.
And she was certifiably insane. Breivik, and so Breivik, they try to call Breivik insane. Now, of course, there's a political angle to that, because if you're sane in Norway and commit a crime, then punishment, even for murder, only allows 21 years.
That's right, 21 years.
Maybe with a possible extension if the person were still, quote, a menace to society. But if you're considered insane, they could put you in longer, because they could still say that you were crazy or whatever and keep you some more. So in the original, I think, psychiatrists, perhaps influenced by the political system there, were seeing what they could do to kind of lean things toward the diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia. The defense man, Lippestad, wanted his psychiatrist to conclude the other way. And so there was another wave of psychiatrists, including some colleagues of mine, who said, no, we can't call him psychotic or schizophrenic. He has instead a very severe personality disorder.
Well, you use the term crazy, which I feel good about using now, because a renowned scientist like you uses that term. But the second part, the second report, you mentioned the paranoid schizophrenic part, you know, with those first group of analysts. And then the second group had him designated as an extreme narcissist. Maybe you can explain briefly, you know, what a paranoid schizophrenic is and an extreme narcissist.
A paranoid schizophrenic, first of all, it's a subtype of schizophrenia, which is a severe disorder, psychosis, meaning that the person who suffers it has a radical departure from a grasp on reality. You remember this fellow Richard Chase, the vampire in California?
Serial
killer, He went, now, before he'd committed his murders, so that it wasn't something he said in order to get off. Before he committed his murders, he went into an emergency room in Los Angeles and said to the nurse, like, what's your complaints or what's your trouble? He said, someone stole my pulmonary artery. Now, and he meant it. So, or the people that say the fillings in my teeth are broadcasting to the outside world that I'm a homosexual, or that the CIA is hiding under my bed and recording my thoughts, those are very, very severe departures from reality, typical of a schizophrenic, particularly a paranoid one with persecutory, the world's against me ideas.
Well, it was very important for Breivik to try to convince everybody that he was sane. What does that tell about him? I mean, you know, he went out of his way, you know, during the trial and all that to try to show that he was sane.
Because he wanted not to be thought of as a nut job. He wanted to the world to know that he felt that he was doing something that was harsh, admittedly, but that needed to be done to save Europe and Western civilization and Christianity, you know, from the Islamic incursions and so on. And that he was therefore at the vanguard of a movement, you know, to try to reverse things and create a civilizational war. where Christianity reasserted itself, Judeo-Christianity, because he was also very pro-Zionist, asserted itself against the Muslim attempts to take over Europe. That was his belief, and he felt that he was a righteous person doing an act that needed to be done. It was tough, it was harsh, but as Mao Zedong said, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs.
I've got a quick one. Go ahead. During the trial, Dr. Stone, he was quoted, Breivik was quoted as saying, I'll now quote, he said, "My whole body tried to revolt when I took the weapon in my hand. There were 100 voices in my head saying, don't do it, don't do it." So why did he do it?
I think because the balance between recognizing that this was going to be judged in a very negative way versus his conviction that it needed to be done anyway, there was a conflict going on in his mind, which is not altogether incomprehensible after all, but the balance tipped toward going ahead and doing it. But I think you're not talking about hallucinations, like voices that were external. In other words, a hallucination is best defined as the supposition, the false supposition, of course, that this voice is coming from somewhere out in space. And it often takes the form of a person talking to yet another person about the individual. Mm-hmm. So that, supposing you have, let's say, a person, a schizophrenic person, imagines that his high school teacher was talking to his mom about what a lousy skunk of a kid the person
is. Right.
that's a persecutory hallucination, an auditory hallucination. Struggle. We all talk to each ourselves in our heads, and when we mutter to ourselves in our heads, "Do this, don't do that," and that I think was the struggle going on in his head.
Right. One of the things I found interesting was he was so concerned about his image. You know, the way he dressed. You know, the suits and the ties and all that. And evidently, you know, he wanted to present himself to the people of Norway and around the world, showing that he was a man in control. Doesn't that to me, you know, I'm just a layman, doesn't that show that he's sane?
Yes. Yes, it does. But also, since some of the diagnoses centered around narcissism, which has to do with egocentricity, grandiosity, imagining that you're a higher-up person in the world and a better person and a more important person than you really are, he had a lot of that. And it's interesting you mentioned his image, because when he was in his early 20s, about 21 or 2, he had a series of cosmetic surgeries on his chin, his nose, and his forehead to make himself more handsome. And he was a lot worried about his masculine image all during his adolescence. You have to understand that his mom and dad divorced when he was a baby, and he went back from London to Oslo when he was, of course, a child. And then mother married this Norwegian officer, and then, when he was 12 years old, the father and the stepmother divorced, and the mother married a Norwegian officer. But during the early years, he was basically brought up just by his mom, and he felt angry at what he called the feminizing influence of his so-called matriarchal upbringing. So he also had a thing against the idea of being too much under the thumb and power of women, which was another beef that he had.
Right. He hated Sex in the City, right? In his closing, at the end of the trial, he railed against Sex in the City, you know, the TV series on that, which was really bizarre.
So the personality, of course, a very severe personality disorder, and there's paranoid elements, the idea that there's this combat that has to take place between the good people, the Jews and Christians, versus the Muslims, and the narcissism, the grandiosity, thinking of himself as the main person in the new version of the Knights Templar that, of course, once guarded the Christians against the Muslims and led them over from France and Italy to Jerusalem, and then protected them and helped fight the Muslims in the 13th century and 12th century, So he's like the new Knights Templar person,
right.
Imagining himself to be part of an organization that probably is either non-existent or much smaller than he imagines, or,
right.
or that he boasts of. But that's that part of his personality. And the other part of his personality that several of the psychiatrists referred to, including this Dr. Aspas, who was, I think, helping for the defense, saying that he had Asperger's syndrome. Now, Asperger's syndrome is a kind of high end of the autistic spectrum where you have a person like Jeffrey Dahmer who has very poor ability to empathize with the feelings of other people and who usually have one monomaniac preoccupation that animates their life. In other words, they just devote their whole life to one interest or one study. In case of Dahmer, when he was a boy, 5 or 6, he liked to carve up animals and look at the different colors of the organs in their belly. I mean, the liver's brown, the spleen's purple, the tummy's yellow, and he was transfixed by that. And of course, that was his one abiding and overriding interest all the way until the time that he, of course, killed actual adolescents and again looked at the different organs in their body when he killed them and carved them up. And he had this coldness and inability to back away from hurting another person that a normal person is equipped with, thank heaven. So, and I think the idea that you can stand in the middle of this Ut-Oya island with a rifle and just pick off one kid after the other, you have to be very cold. You don't have to be crazy. You have to be mean and cold and realize and think of yourself, these people's lives are worth nothing. They're just these hopeless Norwegian liberals that want to let the Muslims come in and take over.
Right.
And I have to get rid of them and make a statement and give Norway what he thought was a kind of a wake-up call. And he had a kind of a motto that he had. As far as why he did that, in Norwegian it goes, it's one sentence: Historien viser at man av og til må gjennomføre en liten barbari for å stoppe en større barbari, which means history tells us that once that every now and then you have to commit a little gruesomeness or a little atrocity in order to stop or prevent a bigger atrocity. That was his idea. In other words, if I don't kill these 77 people, the Muslims are going to come in and take over the whole damn country.
One second, Willie.
Go ahead.
You know, any way you look at it, he's a fanatic.
Yes, and absolutely.
This raises the question, is fanaticism a form of madness? Because, you know, you take the bomber that killed those five Israelis the other day, and you just went in there and on the bus and just blew himself up. I mean, that's craziness.
No, it isn't.
Can it be diagnosed as a form of madness?
No. There are fanatics who are crazy, but then you have to pay attention to the definition of this radical departure from reality. Like the person, like Richard Chase, who said someone stole my pulmonary artery.
Mm-hmm.
The fanatic is often of a paranoid mindset, and of course, somewhat grandiose, and thinking he's doing God's work.
Mm-hmm.
But the typical terrorist, like the 19 people that ran into the World Trade Center, none of them was crazy. They were all religious, very devout men who were radicalized by their elders, and under the leadership of Muhammad Atta, who was one of the least, personable or least conventional person. He was gay. He was a very cold person. Many of the other 18 had families. They had girlfriends. They liked to go to bars and drink and all that sort of thing. But when the elders that ran things said, this is the time you have to get in that plane and run into the World Trade Center, you know, for the greater glory of Allah, they did it. And they were not, they're crazy. They were fanatics. Now, Timothy McVeigh is another fanatic, but he's more of a loner. So he's closer to the edge of being like right. crazy, and yet still not being crazy.
Right. We'll leave Timothy Gazay for another show. We want to get you on and talk about some of the, you know, the famous serial killers and mass murderers in history, and we run out of time, Doctor. This is really fascinating discussion, and we want to point out to our audience that you're the author of Anatomy of Evil, which is a great book, and so you can purchase that book to see some of the cases Dr. Stone worked on, and we wish you good luck in Scandinavia with your panel.
Well, thank you very much.
And keep us informed about what about your activities. You're always a fascinating guest. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stone. Fascinating interview. Thank you very much. Well, Ronnie, again, a very special special thank you to our previous guests, Allison Statman, Bree Fate, and Dr. Michael Stone. We're delighted to have them on our program. Great interviews. Hey, Ronnie, what did you learn about our show tonight?
Well, I learned that Sharon Tate story still has a lot of legs. A lot of people are fascinated by it, and our guests really shed a lot of light on that story, so we're really happy to have them on. And, of course, I always think I have the most interesting job in the world, but Dr. Stone interviewing all of these crazy people, I mean, I think it's much more, has a leg up on us in terms of fascinating occupations. How about you, Willie?
Well, I learned we're going to have him back again, that's for sure.
Right.
Also, you know what? I learned that the Tate family went through hell after Sharon Tate's murder by the Manson family. That's almost 43 years ago, man. Time flies. She was destined for stardom, but it was not to be, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
As for Dr. Stone and the Anders Behring case, I learned that there are probably a lot of crazy people just like Breivik. Well, he doesn't think they're crazy, but I think he's pretty. He's a pretty loony character.
Yeah.
Listen, there's a lot of people out there. I'm going to go hide under my bed.
Well, remember, you might find communists under there.
Communists, my God. You never know.
You know, so yeah, there's no place to hide. You can, as Joe Lewis once said, you can run, but you can't hide.
That's right. Well, anyway, we had a great show tonight. Thanks again to our guests. Now, just a reminder for all of you listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for July the 26th, where we'll have authors Richard Moody and Charles Buckley, who wrote that great book titled The Charmer. They'll discuss the true story of Robert Reldon, rapist, murderer, and millionaire. It's going to be a great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar, put it on your BlackBerry. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure.
The crazies just keep on coming, will you?
That's right. Well, anyway, we hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening, the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Shepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. For all of you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we'd like to thank all of you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Shepsik and myself, Will Harib, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.